This is the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. Embracing the mission of excellence, innovation, and scholarship, the ASC is impacting surgical education globally.
Everyone, this is your podcast moderator, Mingli Wang. Thanks for joining us. I'm excited to introduce my guest today, Dr. Liam Snyder, pronouns they, them. Dr. Snyder is a urology fellow with experience in gender-affirming surgery at Utah. They are a champion of transgender and gender-diverse individuals in surgery and seek to promote an inclusive and supportive surgical learning environment for surgeons with intersectional identities. Dr. Snyder is a lead author for the upcoming chapter on gender identity for ACS DEI Toolkit. I met them through the ASC DEI committee, where I saw them take the lead on making recommendations to the ASC board to make this year's meeting at Orlando more gender inclusive. I also had the chance to get a sneak peek at their most recent submission to Journal of Global Surgical Education titled The Transgender Trainee, Creating an Inclusive Surgical Learning Environment for Transgender and Gender Diverse Students and Residents. This manuscript helped me begin to understand lived experiences of transgender and gender diverse medical students and residents in the surgical learning environment. And I'm hoping to spread some of that knowledge today. So Dr. Snyder, for our listeners out there who are less familiar with the term transgender and gender diverse identity, what does it mean?
Thanks so much for having me, Mingli. So currently when babies are born, they're typically assigned a gender or sex at birth based off of their phenotype or physical appearance. Later in life, when people develop their gender, people develop their gender identity. This is different from the gender or sex that was assigned at birth. So your gender identity is your internal sense of your gender and how you perceive yourself. So when the gender assigned at birth matches the person's gender identity, that person is cisgender. And when the gender assigned at birth does not match the person's ultimate gender identity, that person is transgender. Then there are some folks that feel the terms transgender might not fit or how they see or describe themselves, but they also may not identify as cisgender. So the term gender diverse includes all of these people who might not feel exactly aligned with a transgender or cisgender identity. These are umbrella terms, so people can identify as many things. For example, many non-binary people or people such as myself who might not identify strictly along a binary male or female identity. Some non-binary people consider themselves trans. Some people just prefer to use the term non-binary and might not consider the term trans really feels like them. So you can, have multiple overlapping identities when it comes to gender diversity. I think for the sake of brevity, you know, for a podcast, I might often use the term trans throughout this conversation, but just clarifying up front that I'm also meaning anyone that kind of falls out of that mainstream cisgender identity, including other gender nonconforming or non-binary people that might not use the transgender terminology.
Perfect. So I like to know, why do you think that we need to discuss trans identity in the surgical community right now?
Well, I think firstly, because no matter what field you're in, you're going to treat trans and gender diverse patients. And secondly, we're just also your colleagues. So you wouldn't believe the amount of social media DMs and emails and face-to-face encounters I have had with junior colleagues, residents, students that are coming up the ranks in surgical training now. And they've approached me because they identify as trans or non-binary and they just want to know, you know, can they do this? Can they be a surgeon? Like what challenges are they going to face? And some of them are openly identifying as trans, and many of them are not openly identifying as trans, and they might not be out in their medical school or programs yet. So, you know, when we talk about the importance of these identities, you know, I also want to highlight the importance of representation. So one thing we know from research in other marginalized communities is that when providers have shared backgrounds or lived experiences with their patients, patients also experience better outcomes and better quality of care. And while it's certainly never the responsibility of colleagues from, you know, any marginalized background to educate the rest of us, the presence of these colleagues from diverse backgrounds inherently improves our cultural awareness and understanding of people and patients that are different from us. And one of the people that I interviewed for my project on trans trainees brought up a great point. And he said, not all of us are activists. He just, no one in his program knew he was trans. You know, he didn't want to be an activist. He just wanted to be a surgeon and be a surgery resident. And so that's something important to keep in mind as well. So some people just want to exist, whether it's being, you know, a BIPOC surgeon or a bilingual surgeon or a trans surgeon, they just want to exist and have the same opportunities and access as everyone else. But some of us are activists and educators, and some of us are putting ourselves out there and wanting to be involved in DEI initiatives and bringing awareness to these issues, especially in this culture now where the very existence and promotion of diversity has somehow become a political or controversial topic. And then finally, yes, I say, you know, education is central. It's really important to have representation. It improves patient outcomes. But just caring about our trans colleagues and trainees is just kind of the right human thing to do. And elevating our colleagues from other marginalized backgrounds just helps us all become successful surgeons and better surgical leaders and educators.
Well, Liam, I really appreciate you serving as allies to the students and residents who haven't come out. And I was wondering what barriers or challenges is the trans surgeon or trainee facing, and how do you support them?
Great question. I made some Cliff's notes so that I can try to make sure I've addressed as much as I can in this discussion. But prior to, so my research project was a qualitative research project conducting semi-structured interviews with trans and gender diverse medical students and residents. So that's where a lot of my data is coming from. Prior to this project, the barriers and challenges that were specific to trans surgical trainees had not been investigated. But there have been some, you know, relevant research into both trans trainees in general and in LGBTQ plus lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer, and other, you know, marginalized sexual orientation and gender identity residents. So one thing we knew from prior research was general surgery residents who identified as LGBTQ plus face more discrimination and harassment than their peers. They're much more likely to consider leaving their surgery residency program and are more likely to consider committing suicide than non-LGBTQ plus residents. LGBTQ plus medical students that are, there was a study that asked them about their perceptions of inclusivity and how comfortable they would be in different fields. And the five lowest fields that they felt were least inclusive were all surgical fields. Finally, there was a 2019 study that had some really great data, and it wasn't on surgical trainees, but it was just on trans residents and trans physicians. And that study by Asa Radix showed that 57% of trans residents were out or like let their programs know that they were trans. But that means nearly half of residents in residency programs that identify as trans didn't even tell their program out of fear of transphobia and discrimination. Other data that came out about trans physicians were that 69% of trans-identified physicians had heard colleagues make derogatory statements about transgender patients. 78% of trans physicians censored or modified how they acted or spoke at work to try to hide their transgender identity or try to avoid being suspected as being trans. and 43% faced barriers in applying to residency based off of their trans identity. Meanwhile, we know that the amount of medical students who are matriculating and coming into residency programs, the amount of those folks that identify as trans or non-binary is increasing. The latest data that I have is from the AAMC in 2021, which shows that 1.2% of medical students now identify as trans. It might sound like a small number, but that means every year there's several hundred students making decisions on residency programs and specialties and where they're going to be comfortable. And then something that I know just based off of my experience is that these students and residents seem to be overrepresented in the groups of trainees that are coming up to me that are interested in caring for trans patients and being involved in gender affirming care, like gender affirming surgery. So I can tell you it's well over half of the students or residents that have told me they'd love to do gender affirming surgery actually have identified as trans or non-binary themselves. And almost all of the students and residents that have approached me interested in gender affirming surgery identify as somewhere within the wider LGBTQ plus community, even if they're not trans themselves. So I think it's really exciting that we have this increased pool of possible representatives that could come into surgery and not just be involved in gender affirming surgery, but just creating a more inclusive field overall. So the issues we're up against, and, you know, again, this is just the data we have from our interviews and research. So I'll just highlight a couple of those. And so one thing that's particularly relevant for the field of surgery is the access to facilities. So that means bathrooms, locker rooms, scrub machines. So across the board, many of the people we interviewed said that they had to go and look for where they could go to the bathroom before a surgery or in the, you know, if they needed to take a bathroom break during surgery. One participant described having to find a gender neutral bathroom that was 8 minutes away from the OR and 8 minutes farther than anyone else. So that's kind of a 16 minute trip if they needed a bathroom break during surgery. They also describe not having anywhere to change. So one tactic that students and residents would use is they would either take scrubs home with them and be washing them at home, which was against policies and rules, or they would have a colleague or like a friend go in and get scrubs for them. And then they would take the scrubs to a gender neutral bathroom on a different floor far away, change, and then come back. And if that gender neutral restroom was occupied, that could make them late to the operating room and make them kind of look bad and get bad evaluations from the attending surgeon. Locker room access was a big deal. A lot of times the scrub machines were inside of gendered spaces. And it's not just the scrub machine to get the scrubs, but also to return the scrubs. So people might not be able to get the scrubs out themselves, or some people will run into a gendered locker room, try to get their scrubs, and then run out before someone sees them. Some people will run in and grab the scrubs inside of the gendered locker room and then go to like a single stall within the locker room. Some of the students described, you know, not having any other choice and then trying to change in the corner of the locker room, but one medical student, he was a resident. One resident would hide in the corner and try to change, but it was a concern that people would see that he had top surgery because he wasn't out as trans and no one knew he was trans. So when he was changing, he was really worried that someone would be able to, you know, if he didn't have a single stall bathroom to change in, that someone would be able to figure out he was trans because he was changing in the corner and had scars. So these are all issues that, you know, really affect students and residents and, you know, your colleagues as well, I think, in the scheme of how the hierarchy goes. Not having those facilities, it's really embarrassing to tell your attending surgeon, sorry, I'm 16 minutes late because I had to go find a gender inclusive bathroom at this like offsite rotation. So a lot of times trainees just won't say that. And then the perception is, why is this person late to the operating room? Why did the bathroom break take 20 minutes? These kinds of things that trainees are facing. Another thing that happens quite frequently is the electronic medical records can use people's outdated names. So a lot of trans folks have what's called a dead name, which is often the name that was given to them at birth or was their name previously, and they might have changed their name to match, to more closely align their gender identity. So the name from before is referred to as a dead name. And the etiquette surrounding dead names is we don't use them. We're respectful of the chosen names that people are using now. Unfortunately, if the dead name is still the legal name, and there's a lot of reasons why people have not been able to or are not changing their legal name, a lot of times that legal name goes into the electronic medical record. I can tell you in my experience, that's definitely been the case. And people say, who is this person? And why are they prescribing this medication for the surgery? And I go, oh, that's me. You know, and a lot of other trainees have faced this as well, where people don't even know who that is because it's still using their dead name if it's their legal name. In some cases, people had even changed their legal name, but the EMR was still using dead names. So that outed them as, trans or as having their dead name and kind of publicly announcing their dead name within the electronic medical record to anyone who could see a patient's record. So, and I'm talking about, the students and the residents and their name going into the patient chart as their dead name when they're signing progress notes or writing operative reports. And unfortunately, a lot of times when trainees have tried to change this, they've just been told they can't because it's their legal name, or they go in circles trying to fix it themselves without having support from their program director or program coordinator to try to address that issue for them. Another thing that happens quite frequently in surgical environments is misgendering. So misgendering is when you use the wrong pronouns or honorifics for someone that don't align with their gender identity. I think it happens a lot in surgical rotations from talking to residents and students because of the nature of surgical rotations. So if you think back to your kind of like family medicine rotation, at least mine in medical school, I worked with like two doctors the whole month and they get to know you really well. You're in their clinic every day. It's kind of the same staff, the same. When you go on a surgery rotation, you might have, one case with one surgeon one day and then the next day it's a totally new staff. And so for students to constantly have to be trying to, assert their pronouns and tell everyone what their pronouns are and try to combat misgendering in the operating room or in this highly frequently changing environment was really stressful for trainees. And most of them just essentially gave up. They would just, maybe correct one or two people if they thought it was safe, and then generally just didn't correct people on surgical rotations. And that leads to a lot of stress because being constantly misgendered is a source of, stress for a lot of trans people. And it also led many people to think that attendings or senior residents or folks higher up in the hierarchy might perceive that the student or resident doesn't care. Like, oh, they don't say anything when someone misgenders them. So they don't really care. They don't mind. And the kind of the overall consensus amongst folks I interviewed was they very much cared, but they were just exhausted and unable to constantly correct someone, particularly if that person was an attending surgeon or a senior resident where they felt that the power differential really kept them from standing up for themselves and saying like, oh, actually my pronouns are she, her, and not he, him, and having to address that constantly. There was a resident who was very eloquent about this, and she was a junior surgical resident, and she was still constantly getting misgendered and referred to by the wrong pronouns. And she said she would just give up because she just wanted to operate, and she just wanted to like, but she said while she's trying to operate and she's constantly being referred to as he, him, it was just stressing her out, and she's trying to like, do an anastomosis or something. And the new CRNA is like calling her him, and she's like trying to focus on patient care and how distracting that was for her. So next issue is the surgical culture. This was kind of a mixed bag amongst participants. So some people, really, they were like, well, I thought surgery was going to be terrible and surgeons were going to be terrible, but they were really supportive and it was actually not that bad. So I was happy to hear that some people did find some allies they didn't expect and had better experiences than they were worried about because of you know, the reputation that surgical rotations and surgeons have. There were some participants as well that still felt that the surgery culture had a lot of ways to go, particularly in regards to like gender expression. People were still getting negative evaluations because, for example, when there were people that might have been like assigned male at birth, but identified as either trans women or as a trans feminine, kind of a more feminine person. And they would wear earrings or makeup. One, you know, participant described like wearing eye makeup that was really important to her because she felt she couldn't kind of pass, like people could tell that she was trans. And so her wearing like eye makeup and things was very important to her. And then she would be, you know, characterized in evaluations as like unprofessional because of like the use of like makeup or earrings or things that on a cisgender woman probably would not have been characterized as unprofessional. There was another participant who was non-binary and wore very feminine earrings and was told the same thing, that they were being unprofessional because of their jewelry. And their perception was if they had been a cisgender woman, no one would have commented on the earrings. So those kinds of small, you know, little microaggressions that we think about of how we're evaluating whether people are a good fit or whether or not they look like surgeons or whether or not this is appropriate, you know, hairstyles or makeup or jewelry for surgeons, I think is something that we really need to, you know, kind of take into account. Another thing that trainees struggled with was they were always constantly trying to figure out, who are my allies? Who is safe? Who can I come out to? Maybe I'm not out, but I want to tell someone I'm out and I want to tell someone I need a bathroom space. Who is that person? And so they are looking to see like, okay, that attending has a little like pride sticker on her badge, or that attending has their pronouns in their Zoom meeting, you know, background. And all of these small signals that students and residents were looking for to try to guess who was safe to talk to and who might support them. And I found that really powerful because it's such a small thing that allies could do, something like putting your pronouns in your email signature that could signal to a trainee that you are there to be supportive, you are someone that they might be able to approach. And all of these little signals are something that these you know, residents and students are looking out for. And then finally, this was kind of not really addressing our research question, but I was really astounded by the responsibility and desire to protect transgender surgical patients that almost all of our interviewees independently talked about. It was really astounding because they were actually much better at standing up for trans patients than for themselves, I felt like, talking to a lot of these folks. They especially felt this stress when they had like a transgender patient who was under anesthesia, where that patient no longer has a voice and is in this vulnerable situation and might be now misgendered by surgical staff who might not recognize the importance of continuing to gender the patient correctly. And these, you know, third-year medical students would then become like the loudest person in the operating room of like, no, this patient's pronouns are she, her. And even, you know, for the trainees across the board, whether or not they were interested in gender-affirming surgery or caring specifically for transgender patients, whenever, you know, one participant described, like, whenever there was a trans patient on the service, it was, you know, just general surgery, but they were like, if there is a trans patient on the service, like, I made sure to grab them. I made sure I was the one rounding on them. I made sure I was the one taking care of them. And you know, as we talked about earlier in this podcast, you know, it certainly shouldn't be the responsibility of the trans resident to take care of the trans patients, but these residents and students were proactively themselves, like, felt this desire to care for and protect and watch out for trans patients, which was another theme that we kind of discovered incidentally that was really powerful. So I'm not sure if these go into the next questions, but yeah. So I think those were that was a long answer to your question about kind of barriers and challenges. And I know we might talk about some things we can do next. So
exactly, because we are surgeons and we like solutions. So I see a wonderful future ahead of you. a few years down the line, you are the chair of Department of Surgery, and you're given a very privileged leadership position. What steps would you take to support trainees, trans colleagues, and transgender care in your department?
That's a great way to ask that question. Thanks. So there are so many things that can be done proactively. So for anyone who's comfortable showing visible signs of allyship, so that means pronouns everywhere. putting my own pronouns on my badge, my own pronouns on my Zoom profile, my own pronouns in my email signature. I personally have a diversity of pride flags. I know, you know, one of our gender affirming surgeons who is an ally wears a lanyard that has the transgender pride flag colors on it. All of those things are those visible signals we talked about that signal to not only your residents and your students, but also your patients and your colleagues that you are someone who is supportive and is there for them to, you know, you don't have to be the world's expert on, you know, transgender surgeons. You just have to show that you're willing to be supportive and that you're open to having discussions and learning more. So those are all really, you know, simple signals that we can all make. One thing that I would definitely do as a chair of surgery or as a program director is have a very explicit diversity statement. I know with some legal there's some legal ramifications in many states now, so people are having to be creative. But that was another thing that was brought up when students are looking at residency programs. One of the only things they have to go off of when they're deciding where to apply for a surgery residency initially is the website. So if your website doesn't have anything about DEI, doesn't have anything highlighting, you know, initiatives and trainees were very, open about what that could look like. So some folks were like, well, even if they just have like, you know, a spotlight on like BIPOC communities and like, even if there's other diversity, you know, statements or initiatives in the website, then that trans trainee is going to say, well, maybe this is a residency program where I should apply to or where I'll be safe. So having those explicit diversity statements, making sure the DEI statements are inclusive and mention things like gender identity, gender expression, and then beyond diversity statements, having examples of how the residency program has supported residents or faculty even on the, you know, department website from diverse backgrounds. All of those things make a difference to the perception of residents and potential, you know, even potential colleagues that are looking for jobs about what your department of surgery or what your residency program supports. And then I think, you know, another thing that I would do is try to anticipate these issues. So I know now some of, you know, the low hanging fruit. I can go to the operating room and I can look, and I know, because in my case, I would have to look to find where the scrub machines are that are not in the women's restroom or in the men's restroom. If there's no scrub machines out there for folks to access, if there's no gender inclusive bathroom, if there's not a gender inclusive bathroom map, these are all things that I can do right now, you know, as the chair of surgery or the residency program director, you know, even as just a surgeon educator, where I can say, before we have that trans sub I who's not out, who's here and doesn't know, you know, where to get things, let's just fix it now. Let's put the scrub machine here. Let's talk to the hospital administration. Let's, you know, get this done before it's an issue. So those are all things that, you know, working on this project has taught me that you can just walk around your ORs and see where the scrub machines are and where the bathrooms are and try to address some of those access issues proactively. And then finally, I think it's also, you know, if you are putting out these visible signs of allyship, and you're proactive and you're also addressing everything you can proactively, you will have, you know, colleagues or trainees that come up to you and reach out to you and say, hey, you know, I saw your website or your initiative or your bathroom map that you made. I'm having this issue with the electronic record and dead naming and being able to respond to that and be proactive about whatever issues are like being brought up by someone who's joined the department or the residency program. And then finally, one thing, you know, I'll add here is that if I saw, and I've already done this, if I see a student or a resident who identifies as, who I know identifies as trans or LGBTQ plus for that matter, reaching out proactively, because of how the surgery hierarchy works still, unfortunately, we can't just wait for someone from a marginalized background to approach us and say they need help. Because there's still this perception of I'm trying to get honors or I'm trying to match in this fellowship and I have to put on this facade where nothing's difficult and there's no struggles. And so just approaching that, you know, resident and saying, hey, you know, I saw, you know, you have this identity and I know some folks struggle with, you know, access issues. And if there's anything I can do to help you or support you, please let me know. And I think doing that proactive reaching out is something that all of the residents and students I interviewed wished someone would have done more for them. That even a, you know, chief resident or an attending, anyone who would approach them and say, hey, you know, I noticed this happened, or I noticed you're being misgendered a lot in the operating room. How do you want me to address that? How do you want me to help you? If I hear someone misgender you in the operating room, do you want me to correct it right then or talk to the person later? Or how can I help? So doing all of those kind of proactive steps to tell the person that you're there to support them, how they want to be supported, will be really essential to kind of increasing our inclusive environment as well.
Great. You know, I was really astounded by your statistics that you gave. But it's still very low. You know, we like, I have here like 1.5 students identify as trans. So majority of surgeons are probably still of the dominant identity. So what suggestions do you have to enhance our surgical community's understanding of how to be creating and fostering an inclusive and supportive environment for marginalized groups like this?
So, you know, I think the first thing that all of us can do is educate ourselves. So take the time to read, you know, maybe in this podcast, you think non-binary, wow, you know, Liam really didn't explain that very much. Go Google it, you know? So take the time to read and educate yourself. And hopefully once this manuscript gets out, look over that and kind of try to understand a little bit more about the community and the issues that are being faced, particularly in the current, you know, political environment for both your patients and your colleagues. And then, you know, I think that a big overarching theme in the folks that I interviewed was, you know, you can, if you do meet maybe not, you know, a patient that is there for gallbladder surgery, but if you meet a resident or a colleague that is in your program or department or committee, and you know, you're not sure how to be supportive or help, just start by asking. So I think there is a perception, unfortunately, that trans patients or trans people are high maintenance or easily offended, or there's a lot of, oh, I don't want to offend someone. So I don't want to ask them, you know, how I should deal with the fact that the nurse keeps misgendering them. So as long as they don't say anything, I'm not going to say anything. And the vast majority of, you know, the people I interviewed were like, gosh, I wish you would just, the attending would just ask me, you know, just so that's something else, you know, it's a balance because of course, asking your colleague or student, medical student from a marginalized community to, you know, asking them to give you an hour PowerPoint presentation about being trans, you know, isn't appropriate or something that you should be asking them to do. On the other hand, when you have, you know, specific questions or want to offer specific support, you know, saying something like, hey, I noticed you're getting misgendered a lot in the operating room today. How would you like me to help you in that situation? And if the person says, you know what, I just want to ignore it and operate and I don't want you to deal with it, then that's the answer. If the person says, you know, I want you to have a discussion with the circulator after the surgery, but don't bring it up in front of everyone because that would be embarrassing. Now you have an answer rather than just kind of trying to guess how to support that person. So I would tell people to not be afraid to talk to trans people about supporting trans people, because most of us are much more friendly than I fear that people are so afraid of saying the wrong thing or offending, you know, me or some other trans or non-binary person, that leads to a fear of having these discussions about how to learn more and how to be supportive.
Wow, you made it sound so simple. You know, one, just be curious about another human being, and, you know, two, be open to other perspectives, reading and educating yourself. And then also be brave, be an upstander when, you know, when you are a bystander and see something that should be done better.
And you might mess up. You might get it wrong. You might over apologize or say something wrong, but that's okay. That's how we learn from each other. And that's how we move forward together. So what you said about being brave really resonates with me, because you have to put yourself out there, you know, and if you're so afraid of, you know, offending someone by asking about pronouns, then you run into the risk of just allowing someone to be misgendered when you could be doing something to support them. So you know, I think that it's being willing to be humble and willing to learn and willing to make mistakes. You know, if you make a mistake, you learn from it and you have a discussion and you move on and you don't take it personally and you don't give up on supporting trans people because you said something slightly wrong or said something that, you know, maybe could be stated better. So be out there and be brave and don't be afraid to, you know, make a mistake and learn from it.
Wow. Well, the hour is getting short. So I just want to conclude with, you know, a few more questions. So what positive results should listeners expect from this talk?
Well, you know, I think that these conversations are really important because when I've had these personal discussions with folks at conferences and said, you know, just ask your trans resident, you know, what you can do to support them. And then they've circled back to me and they're like, I asked him and he told me and it was great, you know? And so I think that, you know, the positive results are increasing these discussions about a community that, you know, as we mentioned in the beginning, about half of your colleagues that identify as trans, you don't know that. You know, everyone might think, I don't have anyone trans in my department or my residency program. You could have a resident in your program right now who's not out to you, and is living their life, you know, kind of under the radar. And so I think that bringing this to the forefront so that we can increase, you know, the amount of people that feel safe and included and are able to be out if they want to be out, if they want to be open about their trans identity, you know, these are all, you know, really positive results. And I think that ultimately, you know, the goal here is to also include, increase not just the recruitment, but also the retention of trans and gender diverse surgical trainees, because whether or not they become a trauma surgeon or a gender affirming surgeon, it's just going to increase our, you know, both our environment and our diversity within our surgical workforce, but also increase our care and our improve our patient outcomes for our patients as well.
Thank you so much. I have taken away so much from this talk, and I hope our listeners have too. How can they connect with you, Liam?
Well, considering I'm on the move and finishing fellowship, probably the best way to find me is on X, or formerly known as Twitter. It's under my name at Liam Snyder, LiemSnyder. That's usually how people find me and DM me, but I'm usually responsive there and open to conversations and discussions.
And I hope you'll connect with her also, or them also, at the ASE DEI committee, and where we are trying to have initiatives that promote diversity in our workforce and better education for all of us to do better in this area. Thanks, everyone, and I hope we can connect again at our next podcast. Thank you.
And that wraps up another edition of the ASE podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. You can check out many great resources on the ASE website at www.surgicaleducation.com. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast series where we discuss pressing issues in surgical education. We invite you to join the ASE and get involved, and wish you much success in your pursuit of surgical education excellence.